Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee. I've had I can't tell you how many cups of coffee in my life, and this is one of the best.
Twin Peaks is still one of the weirdest TV shows ever, and now more than 20 years after it went off the air, it looks like David Lynch is bringing back Special Agent Dale Cooper and friends. We're going to tell you more about that later on in the show. But first, the Supreme Court has cleared the way for gay marriage to resume in 5 states. The court announced this morning that it will not hear challenges to lower court rulings in Indiana, Oklahoma, Utah, Virginia, and Wisconsin. Those state courts had overturned bans on gay marriage. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate. Hi, Dahlia.
Hey there, Madeline.
Okay, so do we know why the Supreme Court refused to consider these challenges?
No, but anybody who does is going to be the most wanted person at my cocktail party. Everybody's trying to figure it out and nobody knows what happened.
Well, I've been reading some hypotheses, one of which is that it wants to wait until there's a conflicting lower court ruling.
That's possible. The court certainly, it's in a better posture to take a case, Madeline, when there's what's called a circuit split. So far we've got only rulings striking down bans. Ruth Bader Ginsburg just last month at a speech said, we would be in a better position if the Sixth Circuit came down opposed to what we've seen, so maybe we won't take it. So in a way, she telegraphed that they were waiting for a circuit split. But we really didn't need a circuit split given the sort of urgency of the issues on both sides. You had everybody begging the court to take this, and you had states that were not even involved begging the court to take it. So this was really sort of in spite of everybody's wishes that the court settle this once and for all, the court kind of kicked it back.
But the court did tip its hand last year in June when it struck down the Defense of Marriage Act.
Right. Well, that was a year ago. It was 2013. And they did, in fact, the opinion that Justice Kennedy wrote in that case, United States versus Windsor, has been used by every single reviewing court but two to stand for the proposition that that's what the court did. Even though the court didn't do it, it simply said that the Defense of Marriage Act, a certain provision, was unconstitutional. It didn't go so far as to say that state bans on same-sex marriage were unconstitutional, but judges swinging for the fences since then have, in 39 different cases, said this is what that Windsor opinion meant. What Justice Kennedy meant to do was pull the trigger on same-sex marriage. So it's almost as though unwittingly the court unloosed that, and I think folks were hoping that the court would make a final decision and really put into words, yes, that's what happened. But that certainly is not what the court did today.
Is it possible that the court will never rule on this particular issue involving the states?
That is something that's possible. There have been issues where the court simply left it to the several states to sort it out. The court will feel more and more after today, it looks like not just the 5 states you mentioned, but 6 other states that are in the jurisdictions of the appeals court that ruled in these cases. It looks like in a matter of weeks there will be up to 30 states that allow for gay marriage. So that's 30 out of 50. That's an extraordinary number. And I think there is a possibility that the court just lets this go on. Although I think it's probably safe to say that the Sixth Circuit, based on oral argument, we're still waiting for an opinion, but they looked like they were willing to uphold the gay marriage ban. We've got the Fifth Circuit, which is the circuit that includes Texas, that may be willing to uphold the marriage ban. So I think it's possible that there is going to be a conflict. There just isn't one that's big enough yet for the court to recognize it as a conflict.
And so would we have to wait till next term, or could it happen sometime during this term?
No, it could happen. It can happen anytime. The court is still accepting taking certiorari on cases that are percolating up. And I think that what the court really decided today was that in all those jurisdictions that had struck down the marriage ban, where people were poised to go get married, and the court stayed those and said to, you know, the people in those states, for instance, Virginia, hold off, don't do anything, we're going to make a decision. And I think that they just couldn't let that go on any longer. So those stays have all been lifted, and already we're hearing about same-sex couples marrying in some of the states that are affected.
And so will this affect any other states besides the 5?
It will, I think, sweep in West Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Kansas, Colorado, and Wyoming, because they're all included in the jurisdictions of the courts who have now ruled that these bans are unconstitutional. So it looks as though the five immediately, but very, very short order, we're going to see that 11 cases were affected by, 11 states were affected by today's decision.
Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and law for Slate. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So let's find out how it is being interpreted in one state that filed the lawsuit before the Supreme Court, Utah. And we have Terry Gilday on the line, news director at KUER Public Radio in Salt Lake City. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Well, fine, thanks. So what is the reaction there in Utah?
Reaction among the plaintiffs this morning is very excited. I was at the press conference where three gay couples, six plaintiffs, were represented by a local law firm that brought this case to a federal district court in Utah more than a year ago. And they are not disappointed in the least that the Supreme Court didn't take this up. Basically, they believe that since the Supreme Court decided not to look at this, it allows the lower court ruling in the Tenth Circuit and the U.S. District Court of Utah to stand. So for them, it's nothing but outright victory.
And what about on the other side? I understand that the governor is pretty disappointed today.
I think our governor, Gary Herbert, and our attorney general, Sean Reyes, are disappointed. I think among the states that were had their laws struck down by federal courts, the laws that banned same-sex marriage, Utah was a state that took seriously their role to defend the law, not really necessarily on a moral standpoint or a religious standpoint, but that the voters in Utah voted a law into effect in 2004 that banned same-sex marriage in the state, and the attorney general and the governor felt it was their duty to uphold or to defend that law. And so they held a news conference about an hour ago, and they said that they still believe, Governor Gary Herbert still believes that states have the right to define marriage, but he conceded that Utah will uphold the law now. And since the mandate came down from the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver today, county clerks around Utah can now issue marriage licenses to gay couples.
So have people already lined up to get their licenses?
They have. We have reporters stationed down at the Salt Lake County Clerk's House, and we know that our clerk's office, and we know that there are at least three gay couples who have gone down there and applied for licenses and received them. I imagine that number will rise in the next few days. There was a period between December and January, about a 17-day period, where the federal district court ruling was law until the Supreme Court stayed that ruling. And so there were about 1,500 gay couples who applied for marriage licenses and got married in that period of time. And now, today, those marriages are officially recognized.
Well, you know, here in California, we saw a lot of money come from the Mormon Church and its members during the Prop 8 campaign. And I'm wondering if the church or its members made a strong push there in Utah to keep this ban in place and what they're saying today.
Well, we're still waiting for an official statement from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints today, but they held their semi-annual general conference over the weekend, which happens about twice a year in Salt Lake City. Basically, it's a gathering of top church officials, and they have a couple of days of meetings, and it's broadcast all over the world. And one of the general authorities, a man named Dallin Oaks, who's a member of the Quorum of 12 Apostles of the LDS Church, he's part of the governing body of that church, gave a talk on Saturday, again, reaffirming the church's stand that homosexuality is wrong, but being very conciliatory toward LGBT folks, at the same time saying that you know, he didn't want his church and Latter-day Saints to be labeled as bigots or hateful because they stand up for their religious beliefs, but basically conceding that, you know, gay marriage is, as a reality, is really on its way.
Well, what is the public opinion on gay rights in Utah these days?
I think it's changing. I imagine, you know, back in 2004 when the law was passed to ban same-sex marriage and define marriage as a union between a man and a woman in the state constitution of Utah, there was an overwhelming majority that was for that. There are all kinds of pollsters out there now who would tell you that if that same vote happened today in Utah, it would be a very, very close vote. I think that especially in the LDS community, you see a very fervent debate within the Mormon Church about accepting gay and lesbian folks. There are a couple of groups that have kind of sprung up in the Mormon Church that aren't officially sanctioned by the church, but that call for a very tolerant attitude toward LGBT folks. There's one called Mormons Building Bridges, which has marched at the front of Salt Lake City's Pride Parade for the last 2 years. And these are Mormon men and women who are upstanding in the church. They have temple recommends. They have all the privileges of that members of the church have, but they're standing up and saying, you know, it's not really the message of the gospel to discriminate against these folks for who they are. So there's a real fervent and healthy debate within the LDS church about whether or not to accept LGBT folks.
So far, there won't be another move to try to ban gay marriage, you don't think, in Utah?
There's really no legal path. I mean, the state has essentially lost their case. They spent about $600,000 on this. They hired a lawyer outside of Utah, one in D.C., who had had experience arguing before circuit courts and the Supreme Court. They put a lot of time and resources into it, but as the governor and the attorney general said today, there really is no legal path for them to take at this point, and so they must respect the law they must respect the decision that was upheld both in federal district court and in the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Well, Terry Gilday, news director for public radio station KUER in Salt Lake, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Madeline.
And what's your take on the decision not to take up gay marriage? Is the debate over gay marriage over? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up on the program, one veteran court watcher says the Supreme Court has done more harm than good, even in such landmark cases as Brown versus Board of Education. We'll have that next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. As we just discussed, the Supreme Court returns to work today for a new session, the 10th, under Chief Justice John Roberts. But while we look to the court for the final say about the law of the land, our next guest would like to remind you that the court is flawed. Very flawed. In fact, he says the court has done more harm than good over the years. Erwin Chemerinsky is a noted constitutional law scholar and dean of the UC Irvine Law School. His new book is called The Case Against the Supreme Court. Erwin Chemerinsky, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And you start your book by asking a simple question. Has the court been a success or a failure? And by what standards are you judging the court?
The court exists above all to enforce the Constitution. I think the court plays a particularly important role with regard to protecting minorities. Minorities can't rely on the political process for protection. Majorities can generally win in the political process. Minorities of all sorts need judicial protection. The framers were most focused on political minorities, but of course we would think of this in terms of racial minorities, sexual orientation minorities, minorities of all types. Also, I believe the court plays a particularly important role in enforcing the Constitution in times of crisis. History shows that often in crises, people give up their long-term values because of short-term passions. The Supreme Court and the Constitution should make sure that doesn't happen here.
Now, this idea that its number one job is to protect the rights of the minorities, that's not written in the Constitution anywhere. That's just something that is assumed.
The question you have to ask is, why have a Constitution? The Constitution is different from all other laws in that it's very difficult to change. So the question is, why would a nation that thinks of itself as a democracy, that believes in majority rule, want to be governed by a profoundly anti-majoritarian document? I think it's for the reasons that I said. The framers wanted to make sure that the rights of the minority were protected from the majority, especially in times of crisis.
Give us some examples of some cases where the court just erred in the absolutely wrong direction, when it did not rule in protecting the rights of the minorities and instead did the opposite.
From 1787, when the Constitution was drafted, until 1865, and that's a period of 78 years, the Supreme Court aggressively protected the rights of slave owners in the institution of slavery. So in cases like Dred Scott versus Sanford in 1857, the Supreme Court held that even slaves born in the United States are not citizens. They're just property, chattels of their owners. From 1896 to 1954, The Supreme Court said that separate but equal is constitutional. And the problems with regard to the Supreme Court and race aren't just a thing of the past. In June of 2013, in Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder, the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional key provisions of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This is the first time since the late 19th century that the Supreme Court has struck down a federal civil rights law dealing with race. And this was a law that was passed 98-0 in the Senate with only 33 no votes in the House and was signed by President George W. Bush.
So taking those cases, and I think when we look back at Dred Scott and we look back at Plessy versus Ferguson, I think most people would agree those were terrible decisions. However, the court corrected itself, most notably with Brown versus Board of Education. And so isn't there a pattern in the history of the Supreme Court where, okay, maybe they issue this decision that, looking back on it, is reviled, but that they eventually correct themselves?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But even when the answer to that is yes, think of the incalculable human harm when the Supreme Court in Plessy versus Ferguson said separate but equals constitutional. And for 58 years, most of a lifetime, the court upheld separate but equal and allowed states to segregate. Or I'll give you another example, and it's the one the book begins with, a case from 1927 in Buck versus Bell, where the Supreme Court held that a state can impose involuntary sterilization without consent on people that the state deems to be, quote, feeble-minded. 60,000 individuals were surgically sterilized against their will because of that case. Eventually, the Supreme Court came around and implicitly overruled it. But look at the human cost during the time that Buck versus Bell was the law.
Was there a time when you thought, like most of us do, that the Supreme Court is made up of 9 sober individuals who are very intelligent, who make the best legal decisions of the land, and that the court is maybe not infallible, but is an august institution that should be respected, and its final word should be the law of the land?
Well, I still believe the things you said. I believe that the Supreme Court is made up of 9 human beings. I believe that they're trying very hard. But I very much believe it's an august institution, and I believe it's worthy of respect. But what I also think is that for the last 35 years in teaching these cases, I've been making excuses for the Supreme Court. I wanted to say that the Dred Scott and the Plessy versus Ferguson and the Buck versus Bell and the Korematsu versus United States and so many others are the aberrations, and that really the Supreme Court has done a great deal to advance liberty and equality. The reason I wrote this book is I reflect on it. I think the court's not the institution that I thought it was, that I think the Supreme Court has so often failed through American history when it's mattered most in the most important ways.
Well, I think a lot of people would say, but what about the Warren Court? What about that period in our history where the court issued lots of decisions that expanded civil rights and really remade American society?
When I've talked about the court in praising terms, I so often point to the Warren Court decisions, desegregating the South, advancing the rights of criminal defendants, applying the Bill of Rights to the states. And there's so much to praise and commend about the Warren Court. And yet, in key areas, I don't think it did nearly enough. 2 of the cases we most praise for the Warren Court are Brown versus Board of Education and Gideon versus Wainwright, the latter of which said that anyone facing a possible prison sentence has a right to an attorney. Look at each of those. Today, American public schools are separate and unequal, and they're becoming more segregated at an accelerating rate. With regard to Gideon versus Wainwright, so many people being tried for crimes in this country, even capital crimes, do not have competent counsel. And I think that the Supreme Court, including the Warren Court, deserves a great deal of the blame for not going nearly far enough in these areas.
But what could they do? I mean, the court issues its decision in a particular case, and it's up to the states to interpret it.
With regard to Brown versus Board of Education, I think the Supreme Court could have set timetables for desegregation. I think the Supreme Court could have outlined the mechanisms by which school boards should be desegregated. I think it should have given a much clearer mandate to the lower federal courts. Brown was May 17, 1954. In 1964, a decade after Brown, not one black child was attending school with a white child in Alabama, Mississippi, or South Carolina. It wasn't until 1971, in Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg Board of Education, that the Supreme Court finally said, these are the things to do to achieve desegregation. The court could have done that a lot sooner.
I'm speaking with constitutional law scholar Erwin Chemerinsky. He has a new book out. It's called The Case Against the Supreme Court. You powerfully argue in your book that in all sorts of instances, the court has failed, whether it is protecting racial minorities or other minorities, or whether upholding the rights of American citizens in times of crises. Are you saying that the court, by doing more harm than good, should go away, that we should get rid of the Supreme Court, that we should find another way of litigating these very important issues in our society?
No, I'm not saying that. There are some very influential professors who have made that argument. Yet as I reflect on what they've said, I realize that for so many people, it's the courts or nothing. If we're going to enforce the Constitution, especially for minorities and the unpopular, we need the judiciary to do it.
Well, other countries, most notably Great Britain, don't have that system, and yet they are functional democracies that aim to protect the rights of minorities.
You're right. In the Netherlands, no court has the power to declare a law unconstitutional. So it's certainly possible to have a democracy and freedom without judicial review. And yet I worry in this country, given the tremendous diversity of opinion, given how heterogeneous it is, what would it mean to not have judicial review? Does that mean that every local government that violated the Constitution would be unchecked? Every school system that wanted prayer, every state that wanted to restrict contraception and abortions, where would be the enforcement of the Constitution? Enforcement requires the judiciary.
However, as you say, the judiciary is made up of people. It's made up of people who are appointed in certain periods of time when there are certain political persuasions. And these men and women reflect the political atmosphere of the time, and they reflect the president who has appointed them and that man's particular leanings. And so will maybe reflect the passions of the public at any given moment. Is that at all avoidable?
I hope so. I think we want to have the Constitution to limit the passions of the moment. We want to have courts to enforce the Constitution to limit the ability of the passions of the moment to cause us to lose sight of our long-term values and commitments. I think we can and should expect the Supreme Court to do a better job in the future than it's done in the past.
And how can it do that?
I think all of us, including the justices on the court, should openly admit the mistakes of the past. I think the Supreme Court should say that Korematsu versus the United States, where the Supreme Court upheld the evacuation of 110,000 Japanese Americans from their lifelong homes, was wrong. I think that the court should say, obviously, a case like Plessy and Dred Scott and so many others I discuss are wrong. If we're going to do better in the future, we have to face and acknowledge the mistakes of the past.
How do you answer the argument that you are a liberal who is complaining that the court is too conservative?
Of course, any argument I make is my interpretation of the Constitution. I didn't want to write a book, The Liberal Case Against the Supreme Court. I purposely focus, especially the first half of the book, on examples that I think liberals and conservatives can agree with. I don't think anyone would defend some of the cases we've talked about, Dred Scott or Plessy versus Ferguson, or the World War I cases where people are put in prison for criticizing the draft, or Korematsu versus United States, or a case we haven't mentioned, where the Supreme Court struck down the federal law prohibiting child labor and countless children suffered as a result. So let's start with the cases that liberals and conservatives would agree are wrong. And then I'll acknowledge when I'm talking some of the Roberts Court cases, it's much more ideological and there'd be a disagreement between liberals and conservatives.
Erwin Chemerinsky is dean of UC Irvine School of Law. He's the author of a new book called The Case Against the Supreme Court. And thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on the program, jihadi hunters, ordinary Americans using social media are sometimes better able to track groups like ISIS than the CIA is. That story is next after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. On Friday, the militant group Islamic State, or ISIS, posted another video of a beheading, this time of Alan Henning, who had entered Syria to help deliver aid. In Britain, he was a taxi driver. ISIS identified Peter Kassig, an American aid worker from Indiana, as its next victim. U.S. intelligence agencies have had a hard time keeping up with the sudden rise of Muslim extremist groups, but some ordinary Americans have become adept at tracking these groups and have been able to figure out what's happening in the jihadi world long before the CIA or the FBI. Thanasis Kambanis has written about these so-called jihadi hunters for the Boston Globe. He joins me now from his home in Beirut, Lebanon. Welcome.
Good to talk to you.
Nice to have you. And we have one of the subjects of your article on the line, too. His name is Aaron Zellin, and he blogs at jihadology.net. Welcome, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you, too. Now, let's start with you, Thanasis. How many jihadi hunters are out there, and how do they operate?
Well, there's many dozens. I chose to focus on about a half dozen people who've really earned their stripes over time. So you can find amateur folks who every now and again sort of flash onto the screen. But there's, I'd say, about 10 people who have consistently, over 2 or 3 years now, broken a lot of news and broken a lot of analysis about ISIS, Al-Qaeda, groups in Somalia, groups in Yemen, groups all across the world, really, sometimes groups that the U.S. government isn't paying attention to at all. And what makes these folks interesting is a lot of them are really quintessentially working out of their basements, working out of a home office, some of them working out of their mother's houses, and they're just using open source information. A lot of them are smart people who know Arabic or other foreign languages and are working in local source material, but they've excelled really just by putting together a lot of information that any of us could have access to and using their brains and the internet to go places that the huge expensive U.S. intelligence apparatus lags far behind.
Okay, and we have one of those people, Aaron, on the line now. He's one of the 10 people that you talk about. And Aaron, how did you get involved in this?
Well, I was doing my master's thesis up in Brandeis University in Boston. And while I was writing it, I realized that there was a dearth of information about the primary sources from these particular groups. So when I finished it, I decided to create my website, jihadology.net, because through the process of doing research, I sort of was able to figure out where all this content was, how to find it, and I thought that I'd try and help out other people by posting it on my website as well. And then it just blossomed from there. I never really thought it would get as big as it has, and you know, I've evolved with the times as well, because originally it was primarily on password-protected forums, but now it's more and more so on social media, especially on Twitter and Facebook.
And what have you been able to uncover?
I knew about the Ansar al-Sharia groups in both Tunisia and Libya a good year or so before the attacks on Benghazi and Tunis. I saw the public rise of Jabhat al-Nusra and the resurgence of the Islamic State well ahead of time as well. And I even broke the news after bin Laden's death when al-Qaeda officially appointed Ayman al-Zawahiri, the new leader of al-Qaeda as well, online.
How much time do you spend online?
It's hard to say specifically, but the better part of the day, whether it's on my cell phone or on my laptop.
So what's been the reaction to you and what you've discovered?
I think a lot of people appreciate it since they find it really interesting and are happy that I'm out there and always congratulate me. And so that's good for me.
Yeah. Well, Thanasis, I imagine that the official intelligence agencies might be a little embarrassed by this.
Well, I mean, I think, unfortunately, we have ample evidence that the U.S. government doesn't do as good a job as we'd hope tracking extremist groups. And what we've seen that's kind of interesting in Aaron and other folks like Philip Smith is that essentially, I mean, Aaron's being modest. These guys spend sometimes 20 hours a day online. They're chatting sometimes in the native language with jihadists on these forums he speaks about. They're watching television stations from the Middle East. They're doing all these things at the same time, and it's a crazy level of synthesis that they're engaged in. And it's a project that you could argue a sane and balanced person probably wouldn't try to do and certainly wouldn't do for a long time. But these guys have done it for years on end, and that's why, you know, for example, we'll have one of these analysts will detect a shift, as Philip Smith did, in the subject of the song lyrics of Shindig Troubadours, and they'll use that to make the inference that there's about to be an influx of Iraqi foreign fighters into the Syrian civil war. They'll investigate it in these other fora and turn out to prove it, again, maybe half a year or a year before that becomes official knowledge. Now, that's a crazy leap to make. It's fascinating, and it's in many ways irreproducible, and I think people like that don't get hired by the U.S. government, and that's why they're applying their trade on their own steam. They're sort of too creative for officialdom, and that's their strength.
Well, I mean, why don't they get hired then, or at least unofficially hired, at least hired as a consultant?
I think the subjects of my story are all, I think, on an inexorable path to the kind of respectability that might, in a way, dull their ability to do what distinguished them. I think Aaron and Philip Smith, who I just mentioned, Aaron's now a fellow at the Washington Institute. A couple of years ago, he was just a young grad student. Philip now works for University of Maryland project, and most of them are on their way to having PhDs and what you would call, you know, respectable jobs. And I guess they'll be publishing books and not being online 20 hours a day. And we have to hope that, one, the government hires people like them and encourages its own people to act like them, and furthermore, that a new young crop of 20-somethings steps in to fill their role, because it's something we didn't have before, and I think that we sorely need.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Thanasis Kambanis. He's a journalist based in Beirut, Lebanon, and he's written an article about jihadi hunters. And Aaron Zellin is one of those jihadi hunters. And Aaron, I'm wondering, would you want to work for the government if it came calling, or has it already come calling?
To be honest, I am pretty happy with the situation I have now, since I have a lot more independence. In the government, you sort of have to do whatever they tell you to do, and you can't be as sort of nimble, creative, or dynamic in what you're doing, and you just have to focus on one specific task, whereas I can pretty much follow whatever I'm doing and sort of do it at my own speed, and then switch up right away if I find something else that's interesting. So to be honest, I'm actually kind of happy that I'm in the situation that I'm currently in, and I feel like working in the government, you might be more constrained.
How do you know what's true versus what's propaganda? Because there is a lot of misinformation being thrown out there.
In part, it's just a lot of looking at this stuff a lot of days in a row for the past few years, and it's sort of become intuitive at this point because I know the methodologies of how these groups release content online, sort of the type of propaganda they use, the type of graphics that they use, the type of, you know, lyrics that they use in some of the different music that they put out. So a part of it's just through the experience I've had over the past few years looking at this on a daily basis.
And do you actually talk with these people, with people in ISIS and other groups like that?
Yeah, I've contacted and had conversations with some of these people on the ground in Syria or some of the grassroots activists in the West. I've even had the opportunity to meet some of the Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia individuals in Tunisia last year, so I've been able to interface in person as well.
And who do they think you are? Do they trust you with their information?
Yeah, I mean, these individuals know who I am. They're keenly aware of that, since they're very plugged into the news and what's going on as well.
I mean, do they like the fact that you are publicizing what they're doing and that you're one, two, three steps ahead of the U.S. government?
I mean, I think they find it fascinating because they think that most individuals that follow this stuff or write about it don't know what they're talking about. So So I think that there's some level of respect, since I do get it in some ways.
And Thanasis, how does the U.S. government view these guys in terms of being a help or a hindrance or a possible threat? I mean, do they initially investigate these guys, thinking they might be in league with these terrorist groups?
No, I think what we've seen is a pattern where they dismiss such folks and then eventually come to rely on their research or try to hire them. And the two key lessons I took from looking at the work of these types of folks over the past couple of years is, one, they blend something like old school intelligence analysis with on the ground work. So it's very rare you would find someone who obsessively follows these groups in their public persona, but then also will actually fly out to the Middle East and interview people on the ground. That's something a U.S. government intelligence agency would separate into two completely separate functions. The other thing that's, I think, a lesson for the government to learn, and I don't think it's learned this yet, is to go where the information is. So the government is obsessed with, let's say, taping a million phone calls, and it doesn't pay attention to where the jihadis are doing their talking. And these folks did something, you know, very simple. They said, oh, these jihadis, who used to be hard to find, are on Facebook putting up funeral photos or chants or publicizing their latest exploits, or they're running propaganda on Twitter in multiple languages. Let's take a closer look at what they're doing. And they jumped right on that. And initially, the U.S. government officially dismissed this as unreliable data or useless data, instead of actually just being platform agnostic and saying, let's see what there is of substance here, and if there's good material, let's use it.
Okay, and so this has only happened in the last several years, right? This is a brand new thing.
It's been in the works actually for about 8 or 9 years. I mean, one of the examples I write about is I covered the 2006 Lebanon war as a journalist on the front line. We couldn't figure out with any precision how many Hezbollah fighters were actually involved and had been killed. Hezbollah was officially denying this. In the end, we sort of had to rely on a handout figure from Hezbollah that we couldn't really trust one or another. Fast forward 8 years, you had this community of online folks who were able to actually use Hezbollah's own semi-clandestine Facebook postings as a starting point. They were able to verify names and numbers of Hezbollah fighters killed in Syria at a time when Hezbollah was officially pretending it wasn't even involved in the fight. And they were able to do this using multiple methodologies, right, starting with Facebook, but ending up with actually sending people on the ground in Lebanon to take pictures of funeral posters. And that's something that just wasn't possible 8 years ago, but began as a sort of trickle of jihadi material once Facebook and Twitter went mainstream. So it's been in the works for a while.
All right. And Aaron, what are you seeing now that we don't know about?
Well, besides the big story of Iraq and Syria, which I think will continue to be an important aspect of the jihadi universe in the coming years, I think that we'll be hearing a bit more about Yemen again in 2015, as well as Libya, since you're seeing a resurgence of AQAP in Yemen, as well as the Ansar al-Sharia group in Libya being able to start take some territory there as well.
And what about what's happening with ISIS? Is the bombing working or not?
Thus far, it doesn't seem to be working too well. So we'll see what the United States does next.
All right. Aaron Zellin, fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He blogs at jihadology.net. And Thanasis Kambanis, a journalist, columnist, and fellow at the Century Foundation based in Beirut. Thank you both very much for joining us. All right, Warren Olney is in the room now to tell us what's up at 1 o'clock, 15 minutes from now.
You talked about jihadi hunters. We're going to talk about jihadi bombers. What about the airstrikes that the United States and other countries are launching
apparently
or have been launching?
Apparently not working so well.
Apparently not working so well. That's exactly what we discovered. And in some cases, perhaps even having a backlash and causing more trouble than they are worth in some sense. Hard to get an assessment of that, but a lot of different points of view and a very interesting, very challenging thing. One of our guests, Robin Wright, believes this is a real turning point in American foreign policy history.
Okay, look forward to that discussion at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you, Warren. And coming up on this show, the return of Homeland last night and the return of Twin Peaks in 2 years, just 2 short years. Some of the TV news we'll talk about next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Yes, the theme song for the TV show Twin Peaks. And before you get all nostalgic, Showtime announced plans today to revive David Lynch's surreal cult series. And joining me to talk about that and other small screen news in our weekly TV roundup is Michael Schneider, executive editor of TV Guide magazine. Hello.
Hello.
And also Andy Greenwald, staff writer for Grantland and co-host of the podcast Hollywood Prospectus. Hi, Andy.
Hi.
Okay, so Twin Peaks, that's exciting. What do we know?
This is incredibly exciting. Just on a personal note, Twin Peaks was my first obsession and the first time I ever even thought about TV in the sort of insane, possibly clinical way that led me to doing what I do now. It's very exciting for the show to come back, mainly because this is exactly what TV's new, more nimble Age of the Miniseries should allow us to see, which is the idea of empowering strange idiosyncratic creators to do the things that they do best in a limited way. And so David Lynch, following the lead of, you know, of we saw with Fargo, we see filmmakers working on True Detective on HBO. David Lynch is going to direct 9 episodes of new Twin Peaks material, and that should be cause for celebration.
Yeah, and Michael Schneider, are you celebrating as well? Because I think one of the demerits the original series had was that Lynch did not direct every single episode.
And to some degree, after they solved the murder of Laura Palmer question, a lot of people thought that the show sort of ended at that point. And even though the first season was a huge smash for ABC, the second season kind of trailed off. So now that it's going to be on Showtime, I think that'll allow David Lynch to unleash himself even more. And the fact that it's contained 9 episodes is kind of exciting. And we're still waiting to hear if Kyle MacLachlan's going to be back and some of the other actors are going to be back. But all signs point to good. So 2016 will be here before you know it. And we'll have 9 more episodes of Twin Peaks.
That is the 25th anniversary, so that makes me feel super duper old.
Yes,
so,
indeed.
What else makes me feel old is that I was reading up on this and saw that the original 2-hour debut drew more than 30 million viewers.
Oh, it burned bright, but it burned fast. It's one of those things where I think it helped sort of just change the landscape of prime time at the networks. That was, 1990. That was a whole different world back then. You remember what was in prime time back then? It was mostly pretty cheesy hour-longs.
Yeah.
And then after that, you started to really see prime time change. NYPD Blue came along. Shows like ER came along. And then, of course, cable came and really changed the entire landscape.
But I have to say, I think it's coming back at just the right time, because I think we give TV a lot of credit right now for being innovative and weird, but it's not Twin Peaks weird.
Okay. Not a limited series, because this is the 4th season, it seems. It's maybe unlimited. Homeland debuted last night on Showtime. And what did you think, Michael?
Well, it was nice to see them finally reboot this show. It's something that they probably should have done a season or two ago. But it's a whole new storyline. It's a whole new world. We still have Carrie Mathison and her problems, and now she's a reluctant mother as well. And her relationship with her family is strained. Her relationship with Saul is strained. It's sort of a fresh take on the show, and I'm kind of excited to see where it goes now.
I'm with Michael. I thought the first hour of the return last night was strong, and I think that it hinted at the sort of strong fundamental thriller that the show always could have been and sometimes was. I think the problem, though, is when you remove the sun and stars, as they did with Brody, what you're left with is a lot of floating satellites. There's nothing for it to orbit around. And the damage done by the show's sort of deep dive into the relationship between Carrie and Brody, which went from a fascinating study in paranoia and security into true love.
And they actually had a child.
Yeah, they didn't need to do that. I wish they hadn't. And I think that, unfortunately, the wreckage left by some of the choices made in the last 2 years may have irreparably damaged the show.
Okay, well, we shall see. A new show debuting, The Affair, and this is a very well-regarded show. It's an affair between a married woman and an older married man, and here's a little clip from the trailer.
There is a beating heart to these waves.
There is a magic to this moonlight. There is a danger to this place.
Welcome to the end of the world.
Okay, that seems like the trailer doesn't really tell you much about what
the trailer
it's really
does
about.
Not do it justice. As a matter of fact, that cheesy voiceover guy, thankfully, is not actually on the show. so don't pay any attention to that clip that you just heard. It's actually a very strong show, and it's sort of told in an interesting way. It's the story of an affair told from both actor and actress involved in the affair, and they have very different takes on how this affair began and really ultimately what the impact was, and there's a big mystery at the center of it.
Yeah, I find it very refreshing to see a new show that is not a period piece, that is not based on bad men doing bad violence to people. I shouldn't have to say that, but it's kind of where we are right now. It's rare to see a show that's about the psychological motivations behind more or less real people set in a more or less familiar world. I wasn't totally sold on the pilot, but I think it's promising enough to stick with it, particularly for the reasons that Michael said, which is it's very interesting take on perspective. By telling the same story two different ways, we sort of see how every person makes themselves the hero of their own story, for good or ill.
And it stars Dominic West from The Wire.
He's fantastic. Ruth Wilson also is in it. She plays the other woman involved in the affair, and you know, she's fantastic as well. And Pacey from Dawson's Creek, Josh Jackson,
and Maura Tierney. Don't forget her from News Radio and ER.
Yeah.
So great turns from them as well. So
this is a threefer for Showtime that we're dealing with.
Showtime's kind of kicking it right now. They're doing quite well for themselves. They've got as we've said over and over again, the cliche is this is a golden age, and there's some excellent drama out there right now. You just got to find it.
Okay, well, so let's end on one that is absolutely not excellent. It's called Stalker.
Hello?
I see you made it home, Kate.
Please leave me alone.
Okay, so that's essentially it. A woman is stalked. That is the
premise. Oh, Madeline,
we
were having such a good time. We were talking about some great TV, and then you had to go and bring up Stalker.
I think the bad guy on Stalker is actually the voiceover person from the Affair trailer.
I think so.
Is it as bad as everyone's saying? Or worse?
You know, that's a complicated question because, it's disturbing, and there's some question of whether or not the show is actually kind of glorifying stalking to some degree, and it's not what creator Kevin Williamson is when he's out in the press he's discussing stalking in terms of everything that we understand, which is it's a crime, and it's a trend that is disturbing in that it's growing in leaps and bounds. So it's a serious topic to address, but this is not the show to address it.
Okay. Well, let's remember the good times with Twin Peaks. We started it all off.
Remember that.
25 years ago and, coming back.
The good times will come back in 2016.
Andy Greenwald, staff writer for Grantland, co-host of the podcast Hollywood Prospectus, and Michael Schneider, executive editor of TV Guide magazine. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Madeline.
Thank you.
Such a good time 25 years ago, 24 years ago, whatever.
2016 will be a good time too.
Well, Caitlin Schamberg is here for some feedback.
Yeah, it's glad to be here. So I was reading that more than 34 million people watched the original.
I know.
Twin Peaks. That's incredible.
I was one of them.
Yeah, back in 1990. And that's,
I was only 2 years old, so.
Well, there you go. It's so many people, but there was no Twitter in 1990, and there's Twitter today. And there are so many very, very, very excited people on Twitter tweeting about this. But it all started on Friday when David Lynch tweeted, "Dear Twitter friends, that gum you like is going to come back in style. Hashtag damn good coffee." And that started all the rumors that were, of course, confirmed today. Twin Peaks is back. On Facebook, Eric Hemion said, "This is the best news of all time."
Wow.
Javier Robles said he was stoked. There's so many places the story could go after where it left off. And with a total creative control with the new, you know, in the new show, there's no doubt that those places they'll take it will be amazing. Nick Marshall said, I'm hopeful, but can it ever live up to the original series? And just people are watching from all over the place. Sonora Chase tweeted us, yes, she'll be watching because nostalgia and good storytelling. And then my favorite thing is that on the actual page, the YouTube kind of teaser trailer that they released that we heard part of, Showtime said that the new miniseries will provide, quote, long-awaited answers and a satisfying conclusion for the series' passionate fan base. To which Comedy Central tweeted, Twin Peaks is coming back. Finally, none of your questions will be answered. So much more enigma.
I know. Somehow I feel like they have it down. I don't think all the questions will be answered.
I don't know.
I know my David Lynch.
And he,
which I don't really. So anyway.
I don't think anybody really knows their David Lynch.
It's true. I would love it if he tweeted at us. This is a call out for David Lynch to tweet at us.
Well, you know, he does follow at KCRW. I don't know if he follows at Press Play, but hopefully he will after today.
At KCRW Press Play.
Yeah.
It's the official Twitter handle. David
Thank you.
Lynch.
At David Lynch.
Okay. Well, there's a big picture of him in our lobby, so you'd think. Anyway, Caitlin Schoenberg, thank you very much for your feedback. And keep it coming. You can tweet at us as well at KCRW Press Play or Facebook, KCRW Press Play, and our voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. So you get the theme there. Warren Olney and To The Point up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.